But that's why I like paper.
I hear you. I hear you. I can hear you now. Yes.
And Judge Larkin is here at the MJC, so she should be on in there.
Who's marshaling today?
This is Tony.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
It'd be hard to tell based only on voice.
Well, no, I knew it. I knew who was marshaling, and then I usually have a sticker on my paper, and stickers, you know what happens to those. They get unstuck.
Well, I guess Tim Anderson, my law clerk, is trying to get into the meeting as well, if you could let him in. Okay, got it.
Sorry, I was getting hooked up in chambers. It took a minute.
Good morning.
Yes.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Wilkie, Judge Ross, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals on March 16th, 2022. As you are aware, we are hearing cases on the Zoom platform this morning. By now, I'm sure most of you are aware of the rules that govern the proceedings. Same rules as would apply in the courtroom. We do ask that you be sure to introduce yourself before speaking so you're identified on the audio recording of the hearings. Each side will have 15 minutes for its primary argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. There is a timekeeping mechanism up in the left-hand corner of the screen. Please be mindful of the time. With that, we are ready to hear arguments in the first case, which is A21-1319, Mary Kate Nguyen, Appellant versus Drew Evans, Superintendent, Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, in his official capacity, respondent. And Mr. Colbert, do we have a student attorney arguing this morning?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. We have Martin Sandberg, who has been granted permission by the court to present the argument this morning.
Excellent. Mr. Sandberg, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Martin Sandberg, and I represent the appellate in this matter, Ms. Mary Nguyen. I am a supervised practitioner and joined by my supervising attorney, Mr. Bradford Colbert. We are here today to address whether or not Ms. Nguyen should be required to register as a predatory offender. In our briefing, we raised several issues as to why Ms. Nguyen should not be required to register. But this morning, I'm going to focus primarily on two of those issues. The first is that requiring Ms. Nguyen to register so long after she has completed her sentence denies her finality in sentencing. The second is that the predatory registration statute, as applied to Ms. Nguyen, does not survive rational basis review, and it is therefore unconstitutional. It is on the basis of these two arguments, as well as the other issues raised in our briefing, that we request this court reverse the district court's order granting the respondent's motion for summary judgment.
Sandberg, do you mind if I take you off your tracks and maybe have you focus on a different issue?
If you have a question, Your Honor, I'd be happy to answer.
I'm sure Mr. Colbert warned you that I would do that. So you raise an issue in your brief about who gets to make the decision as to whether there is probable cause. And you point out that your concern that the district court was relying on a different court, but we take a de novo approach to probable cause, don't we? And if so, can't we make that determination on our own, regardless of whether the district court was right or wrong, and whether or not the district court deferred to another court?
That is correct, Your Honor. One of the issues we are raising today, well, I was not originally going to raise in our argument today, but we did raise in our briefing, is that there was an issue with the probable cause determination, and this court does have the ability to review that.
But when you say ability to review it, I mean, we can, it doesn't affect our decision, does it? If the district court was right or wrong in relying upon a different proceeding in determining probable cause, since we're undertaking a de novo review of probable cause. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I believe I agree if I understand what you are asking, yes. But the issue still remains that the original court that determined probable cause, we believe, so we argued the issue that it should be changed or it should be reversed. There's at least a dispute of fact as to whether or not there was probable cause for the underlying charges.
And Mr. What is Sandberg. The dispute of fact as to whether there's probable cause?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
What is the disputed fact as to whether there's probable cause? If we look at the complaint, what's the dispute when, you know, don't we consider the facts in light most favorable to the allegations?
It is true that you review the facts in light most favorable to the allegations. However, we have outlined a couple of issues that we believe were prevalent when probable cause was determined in the first place, specifically whether or not there was sufficient probable cause for the underlying offenses of aiding and abetting kidnapping and aiding and abetting false imprisonment. And we know from recent Supreme Court Minnesota Court of Appeals case, although it's unpublished, that to charge someone with aiding and abetting kidnapping, there must be a specific intent for intent to terrorize if you're charging it out that way.
Mr. Sandberg, this is what bothers me about this case, and it's kind of ironic, I guess, that the judges seem to be focused on the same thing as this probable cause issue. I'm trying to wrap my mind around how, as an appellate court, we sit and don't just accept that probable cause was determined or decide if there was, I don't know, an abuse of discretion or some measure of what the trial court did. Why would we be in a position that if these cases would come up on appeal, that we would go back and reconsider probable cause? It just seems to me to be a laborious process, something a court of appeals should never get involved in. So how do you see this working out? I mean, do you think that's what we would say, is that we can be the decision maker?
I agree in principle that there is a potential for that to be abused. However, we're looking at the specific facts of this case. And based on the facts of this case, because there was such a clear error, that is the reason why we brought the issue to this court, challenging the original probable cause. Because it was the juvenile district court judge that looked at the facts, relied only on petition. No argument was heard on the issues of whether or not there was sufficient probable cause that we believe that it should be challenged here today.
Counsel, it's Judge Larkin. I'm going to help you out a little bit here because I must admit I shared Judge Werke's concern about whether we should revisit the issue of probable cause on appeal when the argument that was that probable cause was insufficient such that registration wasn't justified. But in some of the limited research that I did, I found cases in which our court did that. In other words, the case came up as a sentencing appeal. One of the issues was, should the person be required to register? And the argument was no, because the probable cause determination was an error, and our court reviewed the probable cause determination de novo. So I think there's a history of us doing that. Now, that was done in the context of a sentencing appeal, and that's not where we are here. On the other hand, I appreciate that your client wasn't aware of the need to raise this issue until she was told some 10 years later that she needed to raise the issue. So I guess I'm not completely adverse to the idea that, you know, we can review issues as justice requires, and this might be an exceptional set of circumstances that requires that. But at the end of the day, we would then just look at it de novo and decide whether there was probable cause based on the record, which I assume would be the police reports and complaint, which was submitted, as well as your client's affidavit, which has since been submitted. Is that what you would want us to do?
That is part of our argument, Your Honor. And I do believe it was the case of State versus Hawkins where this court did make that determination that you were just speaking of. There is history for it, and it would be appropriate, yes.
But normally that history is in the context of a timely sentencing appeal where... Then the question I have is this, and I know you want to get back to your two main arguments, but this goes to another issue that's related. One of your arguments is there's a procedural due process violation because your client was never given the opportunity to challenge probable cause or have the case dismissed. And, you know, based on the discussion we've just had, it looks like your client will have had two opportunities to challenge probable cause in the initial juvenile court proceeding where the juvenile statutes require a district court to review the matter for probable cause and make a probable cause determination before there can be a certification hearing. So we had that first probable cause determination, and now we're going to perhaps have a second probable cause determination by this court on appeal. So I question, you know, the foundation for the argument that there's been a procedural due process violation in this case because she's never had the opportunity to get the case dismissed. It seems to me she's now having two opportunities to get the case dismissed by having a court potentially say there's no probable cause for the charge. So is that a fair assessment of the circumstances?
I don't believe it necessarily characterizes it to the full extent. Because we believe that there were deficiencies with the original probable cause determination, it would not satisfy the requirements for sufficient procedural due process. It is true that looking at the case now de novo, that would be satisfied. But fundamentally, as I was saying, there are two arguments that I wanted to touch on today. The first of those arguments is
let me keep you off track for just a little bit longer on the merits of probable cause. Am I correct that the record indicates whether or not there's a dispute about it, there is some evidence in the record that would indicate that your client participated in the planning of the robbery, and that planning included the robbery and a relocation to a different parking lot where the main offenders would be picked up and the group would rejoin. Is that accurate?
Based on the complaint, there is evidence that a robbery was planned. We make no dispute about a robbery being planned. However,
well, just to be clear, a robbery was planned, and that plan included, at least implicitly, if not explicitly, included an initial point of contact and then a relocation at another parking lot some blocks away. Is that fair or an accurate description of the record?
I do not believe that is accurate. Our client's affidavit specifically lays out that she was not aware that there would be a relocation. And that is why we are disputing whether or not there was probable cause for aiding and abetting kidnapping and false imprisonment, because Ms. Nguyen was not aware of the fact that that would be taking place.
No, I understand that's her position, but I'm just talking about, usually when we talk about probable cause, we're looking at it from the perspective of the information available that could support a charge. And in this case, because there was planning and there was a relocation, why isn't it a reasonable inference that planning included a relocation, which would necessarily include a temporary abduction?
What is correct that we are supposed to look at all the available information at the time. However, that was not done in this case. The district court relied solely on the petition. There was no argument heard on the issue. So,
but counsel, my reading of the district court's order is that the lawyers asked the district court to make its probable cause determination on the face of the complaint, which is common practice. Nothing prevented Ms. Nguyen's attorney from requesting to supplement that record, requesting to call witnesses. You know, the Florence case sets out sort of the four ways this can happen. I mean, are you saying that no one would allow her to do that? Or are you just regretting the choice she made to submit it on the complaint?
Well, no, Your Honor. I believe this case is unique in the fact that it could have been the case, and we don't know for certain, I will admit that, but it could have been the case that Ms. Nguyen didn't realize that she needed to challenge the probable cause for those underlying offenses because of the fact that they were being dismissed and because of the fact She did not know the predatory registration was going to attach. Had she known of that, we may not be in this situation right now.
But she had a lawyer, yes?
She did have an attorney.
And we're not hearing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
We are not, Your Honor.
So, I mean, the lawyer would know that. I mean, any lawyer who was doing certification hearings in 2005 on a regular basis knew that the key was the probable cause determination. And that's about the only way you were going to avoid registration when you had companion offenses that were predatory registration offenses.
I do hope that you are correct, Your Honor. What I have is the records from the sentencing hearing, Ms. Nguyen's affidavit. Nowhere in any of the orders was predatory registration ever discussed with Ms. Nguyen. She has no recollection of it ever being brought up at any stage of the argument. And that is exactly why two of the arguments that I wanted to raise today specifically address the fundamental fairness of the sentencing order in requiring her to register when she had no knowledge of it.
Well, let's talk about your sentencing issue. I know that's one that you wanted to discuss, and I do as well. And I've read, the state cites cases saying sentencing or registration is not a component of sentence. It's a collateral consequence. It's a civil regulatory consequence. I come at it a different way. The Minnesota statutes specifically say the legislature determines what sentences are appropriate for any given offense. And that statute says the sentences for felony level offenses may include term of imprisonment, fine, fees, restitution. Nowhere does it include in the list of permissible sentences registration as a predatory offender. So that seems to support the state's argument that although this is a requirement, it's not part of the sentence. The statute that defines sentence doesn't list it as a component of a sentence. Why do you feel that it's part of the sentence?
I believe that there has been a melding of these two components that cannot be denied. And as you were stating before, this court has heard cases on sentencing appeals regarding predatory registration. So in fact, this court has almost affirmed the fact that predatory registration is indeed a part of sentencing. And there is case law that says that predatory registration is a definite consequence of sentencing, because without the sentencing, you would never be required to register. And ultimately,
that's saying it's a collateral consequence of sentencing. You're asking us to take that melding and graft it on another line of cases that says, you know, when a person has a crystallized expectation of the length of their sentence, at some point you can't modify it. And those cases are dealing with the length of incarceration, not collateral consequences or other civil requirements that stem from sentencing. So I think there is a difference, at least to the extent you try to rely on the crystallization of expectation of sentencing.
So yes, in State versus Combs, they do use the language of reasonable crystallized expectation of finality. But the language that the Minnesota Supreme Court uses specifically is whether or not a sentence is enhanced. And I believe the facts of this case demonstrate that the sentence is being enhanced by requiring Ms. Nguyen to register a decade after she was discharged from supervision. So collateral consequence or not, we still see that a sentence has been enhanced here.
Well, I think you're begging the question, is it part of the sentence or not? If it's not part of the sentence isn't being enhanced if it's added 10 years later than it should have been.
And that is why I believe that the melding of these two components is important to recognize, because of the fact that if we are going to say it's part of the sentence, which we are arguing here today, there has been an enhancement of that sentence. And I see my time has run.
Well, you'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal, and you can address the other issue you wanted to, whether the registration statute survives rational basis review.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the state, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case. The BCA properly relied on the record in this case and the district courts, the juvenile courts, finding a probable cause in applying the registration statute to Ms. Nguyen in this case, and her conviction out of the same set of circumstances as the offenses of both aiding and abetting kidnapping and aiding and abetting false imprisonment. if you look at one of the things that Judge Ross asked about, if you look closely at the documents, there is an inference that, and I was trying to find it during the argument because I had seen it in reviewing the record today, but there is information in, it's either in the petition or the court's order that indicates that there was part of the plan was that she would be, the victim would be moved from the initial kind of abduction site or the initial robbery site. And even if that was not an explicit part of the plan or inferred in the plan, it was certainly reasonably foreseeable when they're taking, you know, she was part of the plan, the gun was taken from her house. She knew, you know, she followed them there, she remained in contact with them. So it was reasonable foreseeable when they were taking the gun and they were planning a robbery in a parking lot in the dark at night, that it could lead to either false imprisonment or kidnapping in this case.
I mean, assuming that there wasn't sufficient information in the record to draw that connection between the plan and what actually happened, it seems like a stretch to say that it's reasonably foreseeable that because there is a robbery in a parking lot, that there's going to be an abduction of sorts. You've been at this a long time. I'm sure you've handled many robbery cases, most of which don't include, in fact, few of which include a kidnapping. So where would we draw the line? I mean, how would we say that, would we say that because it's a parking lot, because it's a car, that it necessarily implies that there could be or reasonably will be an abduction?
I think it's reasonably foreseeable, even if you don't, maybe you don't see so many where there's an abduction, but you certainly see a lot where there's a kind of a false imprisonment by somebody being held at gunpoint. They're not able to move where they want to, during the robbery. Right, she knew there was a gunpoint.
But most of those cases, we say, and the Supreme Court has said, well, this is just incidental to the robbery. I mean, if there's just a brief encounter or you're taking someone's stuff. That's the objective, is to take their stuff. And keeping them still and responsive and cooperative with the criminal intent always includes some slight temporary detainment. But that's incidental to the robbery. It seems like you're asking us to take a bigger step here to say that because there was it can't be enough to say that there was a robbery. It seems like you're saying that because there's a robbery in the parking lot, that it implies this foreseeability of abduction. It seems like a stretch to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at the whole record and the whole circumstances. And I think the combination of the fact that she was involved in the planning of the robbery, that again, I'm sorry, I'm not pointing to the exact language, but there is this language that indicates that there was a pickup plan. You know, right. It wasn't look out. It was a plan to pick him up when the robbery was done.
It seems to me that you really need that to show foreseeability. Otherwise, every robbery would be converted to an aiding and abetting and a kidnapping.
Well, yeah, I don't necessarily agree with that, but
where's the information about the pickup plan? As I read the juvenile court's order, it seemed like the juvenile court was just asked to make the probable cause determination based on the face of the complaint. I did not see that the court considered any other statements or police reports. So, I mean, we would have to make our probable cause determination based on either what was before the juvenile court or what has been provided in this appeal, the new document being Ms. Nguyen's affidavit.
Right, and I was only looking, and I can't point to it right now, and I don't wanna spend my whole argument looking for it, but that was something that I just actually noticed today, and I was just looking, all I looked at was the petition and the court's order. So I can't point to the exact language, but I wasn't looking at anything outside of that.
Okay.
And so
we'll look at it again.
But again, I don't concede that there has to be that part of the plan in order for her to be aiding and abetting on the kidnapping and the false imprisonment charges. I think that if you look at the totality of the situation and what her involvement was in the circumstances of the plan being in, I mean, it is in a parking lot and they are planning to rob someone, you know, getting out of their car in the parking lot or getting into their car in the parking lot. And it is reasonable for people in that situation that they could be either falsely imprisoned as part of that robbery or abducted as part of that robbery because it's in a parking lot. And, you know, they're gonna wanna get away from the possibility of getting caught in that.
That would seem like a pretty high, a pretty significant bright line. I think you can make that argument anytime there's a robbery near a car, because cars are vehicles of transportation, and it's foreseeable that a robber would then use the victim's car or somebody else's car. I think it's a, it seems like that's a stretch. I mean, I will certainly look in the record to find what you have indicated you have seen in the record, which is that there was enough before the juvenile court to see a connection in the plan, that the plan included more than just showing up and having the robbery, that the plan also included this later pickup. But I agree.
Yeah, and I'm sorry.
And I agree that you shouldn't have to take your time now during the argument to go finding it. So I'm sure you want to get to other things.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I can't point to the exact, but I would just say with the totality of the evidence, it certainly meets the probable cause standard for both of those offenses. Certainly the false imprisonment and also the kidnapping, if you look at the totality of the evidence, is reasonable, foreseeable from a probable cause standard. And the Halkos case, and certainly this court and other, I think the Supreme Court, even in Lopez, has looked at that probable cause issue. I don't know if it's looked at it as much when it's already been decided below, you know, by the criminal court where the registration was based. But this court has looked in various cases at the probable cause de novo. I believe, and we say in our brief, that the BCA properly relied under Halkos. The important part is the court's determination at the time of the complaint. Well, in this case, that's what the BCA relied on. And I certainly think that was appropriate for them to rely on that under the case law.
Let me ask you a question about substantive due process. You know, the legislative body has continued to roll out expansions to the predatory offender registration. At some point in time, don't we say enough? And we say there is not significant due process? I mean, and is that not present here? 10 years is a long time.
Or at least if we don't say that it, at least we say that it triggers a constitutional issue, that there's some liberty interest involved at some point.
So if you look at the Ward decision, which is the most recent Supreme Court decision on these issues, it did say that changes can be the basis for due process, but it still has to meet the standards for a due process claim, obviously. And the only change in that case that they even let survive the motion to dismiss was this one that dealt with the parenting statute and somebody being for being presumed child abuse. It was a separate statute that's not issue
we're familiar with that, and that was not right. Alleged here. It was there, at least there was an allegation as far as medical care as being burdensome. But you know, I mean, at some point we have to just be practical. And when you look at the overall situation here, you know, what if it was 15 years, 20 years? I mean, at some point we have to break that chain and make a determination that we're being, I hate to say ridiculous, but in some ways, yes, and that burden in and of itself is detrimental to a person getting on with their life and having a second chance or whatever you may choose to call it as far as their forward progress.
Well, okay, so a couple of things, I guess, on the issue is, as Judge Larkin, I think, raised during appellant's argument, this is something where she had an attorney. The attorney should have known the law. And there are all kinds of, you know, the statute that provides for 10 years from the time the person initially registered for the offense purposely has that language because of the idea of somebody being offense-free in the community for that period. It used to, originally, it was 10 years from the time of the conviction, I think, or the end of the person's supervision. So that language was changed kind of to address situations like this. For whatever reason, the court didn't comply with the notification requirements. His attorney or her attorney didn't comply with the registration requirements or know of them in order to inform her. The corrections officer at the time didn't notify her, whatever. So those are all things that are accounted for in the statute. And, you know, there have been cases where and I think it's the Vaughn case, V-A-U-G-H-A-N, that says that about 10 years free in the community. And I think with Vaughn, I think he was informed like 17 years after the fact, and it was an ex post facto claim. But in any event, that's what this court said about that. In her case in particular, Ms. Wynn's case in particular, when you look at unconstitutionally as applied, she has been extended. She would have been extended, I'm sorry. So let's say she registered in 2006. She would have been extended when she was incarcerated in 2007, in 2008, in 2009, in 2010, in 2015. So even, I mean, I'm not saying she got a benefit from not registering for those first 10 years, but she would have still been registering. So she didn't register for 10 years that she should have been registering, but she would have still been registering. And at this point, because she was incarcerated again last year, the year before she was released last year, her time goes to 2031. So even if in some situation you were like, this is just unfair and unconstitutional as far as this offender goes, when she was reincarcerated 6 times since she was initially required to register, it's hard to say that's unconstitutional as applied to her, because she would still be registering now and up until 2031. So if anything, she really got out of 10 years of registering in the first place. Want to see my timing here.
How much more do you think has to be added by the legislature before the registration statute finally overcomes the plus hurdle in the stigma plus standard? What more do you think is necessary?
You know, I don't know. I mean, would it have to be something that was actually would raise it to the level of being punitive? And so far, these things are not things. These are still things that are rationally related to the purposes of the statute. So I can't say a specific thing. I can say that, you know, some of the statutes, even
nothing
even
comes to mind. Nothing comes to mind. You can't think of even one.
Well, like even interest. I mean, it would have to be a liberty interest. I mean, that's what substantive procedural due process talks about, right? I mean, it would have to rise to the level of a liberty interest. And the Wurlick Court, I mean, even looked at some of these DOC statutes that Ms. Wynn, it was a different one Ms. Wynn raises, but it was similar, and said, you know, these were civil regulatory statutes. These didn't, you know, rise to the level of meeting those due process issues in that case. And the other thing is, I mean, registration, and even in this case, in her reply brief, she raises these ordinances that I don't think she raised below, and she didn't raise in her initial brief, but are often raised in these cases. And, you know, those ordinances aren't anything controlled by the BCA, certainly, but a lot of them only apply to level 3 offenders, only apply to certain offenders, and she hasn't alleged any of them have been applied to her. So that's not something she can rely on here on saying that.
No, go ahead, finish your thought. I have one more question.
I'm saying that this doesn't survive due process.
I see your time's expired, but Judge Larkin, if I might ask.
Of course you may.
One short question. Our Supreme Court bases the stigma plus standard on on federal law, U.S. Supreme Court law. Have you had an opportunity to look in around the case law universe to see whether federal courts or whether in other state courts there's been more development that might affect the Boughton standard over time. Any more recent case law that might inform us as to circumstances that have met the plus test in other jurisdictions?
Not really in other jurisdictions. The federal court law that I'm most familiar with is like our Gunderson case in the Eighth Circuit, which upheld all of our registration statute on due process, both procedural and substantive. And we mentioned that in our brief. And I feel like there was a Myers federal decision, but that also was our jurisdiction, M-E-I-E-R-S, Roy Myers, I think. And I can get that information to the court if you want cites on that. But I don't have, as far as the other jurisdictions go, I have not seen anything specifically changing that stigma plus analysis.
Sure. I'm not suggesting changing it, but I'm just wondering whether you found in other jurisdictions or had a chance to explore in other jurisdictions, whether as other states have added things like our state has, that in some place in the country, courts have stepped in and said, okay, now this meets the test. At least it triggers a constitutional liberty interest.
That has happened in some states. My hesitation is a lot of states combine their community notification statutes with the registration statutes or require a lot more than we do, which has then met that. So I guess that gets to your kind of earlier question about what would it take. But because ours are separate statutes, we've always kind of avoided that, that part of the stigma plus. Some states have, I think where it has kind of met that level, are states where they've had specific parts of their statute that, for example, say somebody can't associate, like they're specifically calling out things, they can't travel, like things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's my kind of recollection of, I guess, the distinction between our statutes is that some of them combine that notification prospect or aspect, and some of them do specifically say, there are certain kind of substantive constitutional rights that they specifically kind of address.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
We'll hear from counsel for appellant rebuttal now.
Thank you. There's just a couple points that I want to emphasize. The first is that the respondent relies heavily on the stigma plus analysis. And I'm sorry about my camera. It's supposed to kind of track where I'm at. But we don't even need to get to the stigma plus analysis because we contend that this does not survive a rational basis review. There we go. If we look at the facts of this case, it's clear that there is no rational basis to require Ms. Nguyen to register. We need to look at the fact, first of all, although she would have had to re-up this registration when she was reconfined, she was never convicted of another predatory offense. That is not the case. She was never convicted of a predatory offense. She wasn't informed for almost a decade about this duty to register, and she was a minor at the time of the offense.
Just to be clear, are you focusing on your substantive or procedural due process argument on this point?
Well, I think, interestingly enough, again, there's a melding, but I am talking about substantive right now at this point. But that brings me to my second point, is that the respondent stated that this statute somehow protects against a failure to notify. And I'm just not sure how that can be the case. If she was stating that because you have to register for 10 years and if you commit another crime, you have to re-up that registration. That doesn't protect against a failure to notify. In fact,
I think she was referring to community notification statutes as opposed to registration statutes, if I understood her argument correctly.
Okay. And that may be the case. I think that if we were actually worried about protecting individuals who are not informed of their duty to register, whether it be from the court or from counsel or from a corrections agent, we would need some type of procedural due process hearing to make sure, okay, the BCA failed to notify her or the corrections agents. we need some type of hearing to make sure that now she should still be required to register, because as it stands, it's been 16 years. She has never committed another predatory offense. She never did commit a predatory offense. It would not be rational, I dare say irrational, to require her to register as a predatory offender. And with that, I would concede the rest of my time if there are no further questions.
Don't see any more questions for you, counsel. Thank you for your arguments and your briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within the 90 days required by statute. That concludes.
Thank you very much.
And if I could just jump in here, Mr. Sandberg, I've seen many lawyers. I'm sure my other panel members would agree. When you're in law school, you always wonder, am I up for the task? I'll just tell you what Mr. Colbert surely will tell you, which is you certainly are. So nicely done. This is your first argument?
It is. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I was obviously quite nervous.
No, it wasn't obvious at all.
Did not show.
And if Mr. Colbert doesn't give you an A, you come back here and we'll...
I think it was because of his excellent supervision, frankly, Your Honor. I mean, he was good, but, you know, I had to help him along. So I think I get most of the credit, frankly.
Probably so. Yeah, sure. Surely.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next case on the court's calendar this morning is Rosenberger versus Southtown Incorporated, respondent and respondent Department of Employment and Economic Development. The case number is A21-1070. It looks like we have a certified student attorney appearing. Is that you, Mr. Wallace?
It is.
And you are being supervised by Professor Knapp?
Correct.
Is he here?
Yes. He's in the room next to me.
Excellent. Just want to be sure. And who is appearing on behalf of the department?
Good morning. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I'm appearing on behalf of Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED.
All right. Is anyone appearing on behalf of the employer this morning, or no?
I don't believe so.
Excellent. Well, at this point, we are ready for arguments from Relator. You will have 15 minutes to present your primary argument. You'll have another 5 minutes on rebuttal. Please be mindful of the timing mechanism up in the upper left-hand corner of the screen and watch for judges to signal their desire to ask you questions. With that, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Lucas Wallace. I am here with my supervisor, Peter Knapp, and we are arguing on behalf of Relator, Mr. Timothy Rosenberger. We ask this court to reverse the decision of the ULJ and award Mr. Rosenberger unemployment benefits. Mr. Rosenberger was not terminated for employment misconduct because the ULJ failed to consider that simple unsatisfactory conduct or conduct an average reasonable employee would have engaged in under the circumstances are not employment misconduct. Mr. Rosenberger's conduct was not misconduct because it was both conduct an average reasonable employee would have engaged in under the circumstances, as well as simple unsatisfactory conduct. First, Mr. Rosenberger.
I hate to point this out to you so early in your argument, but doesn't an employer have a right to expect that their employee will not be complained of?
Yes.
And I know you're saying that gets at the fact he was just a bad worker or did not rise to the level of expectation. But what about the fact that there was a complaint and he continued in the same fashion of not showing up with tools or being ready to work? I mean, isn't that misconduct to again go ahead and repeat the same mistake?
Yes, and it likely would be if he was a journeyman. However, here he was an apprentice.
But if he's told to show up with your tools, Got to have your tools to do your work. And then to turn around and not show up with your tools again, does that not show indifference to your employer?
It doesn't. He always had his tools in his van, and he would go walk to the actual area of the job site that he would need to work at that day. Rather than carrying pounds and pounds of tools with him, he'd go look at the job, walk out to his van, and grab what he needed, because, I mean, it seems unreasonable to carry around all these tools when you may just need a drill or a screwdriver for that particular
task. Do you dispute the notion that he was directed or asked to bring tools to the site? And that means not just in his van, but to the site. Do you dispute that?
No.
So why does it matter how much the tools weigh if his, unless it was unreasonable, you're saying it was unreasonable for the employer to expect him to obey the directive to bring the tools to the actual site? That was unreasonable.
When you're answering Judge Ross's question, explain to the panel how that expectation differs from a journeyman as compared to the apprentice status that your client had.
Sure. So a journeyman has mastered the skills and competencies of the trade, while an apprentice is hired to learn on the job, essentially. And he could bring his tools with him before seeing the actual job. But if he didn't know exactly what he would need, I don't believe it to be reasonable for him to carry around an unnecessarily heavy amount.
So you're saying an apprentice doesn't know what he needs and a journeyman does. So an apprentice doesn't need to bring the tools, but the journeyman does?
The journeyman would likely know, but the journeyman similarly would like to go scope out the area and determine what tools he would need as well. So, I mean, regardless of if he's a journeyman or an apprentice, it's reasonable to go look at the actual task before bringing all your tools with you.
Well, you're saying it's reasonable as if, you know, as if we're the ones who decide what's reasonable. If his supervisor has directed him to bring the tools to the site, explain why that's not a reasonable directive, regardless of his title.
Sure. So the supervisor that complained was actually not his direct supervisor. That was the maintenance manager, referred to as Matt in the transcript, the Great Lakes employee. And he was the one who was ultimately upset with Mr. Rosenberger this whole time. It wasn't Southtown themselves. And the Great Lakes facilities manager does not define misconduct. It was his expectations that Mr. Rosenberger did not.
Okay, so that's a different argument. So you're not saying it would be unreasonable for the employer to expect him to bring the tools to the site. You're saying that wasn't an actual expectation of the employer. Is that your argument?
Yes. Additionally, Mr. Rosenberger's conduct was simple, unsatisfactory conduct. The two main complaints that he was discharged for was what we just discussed about him not having his tools on his person. Again, they always were in his van, and him not actively working.
What about cleaning the condenser? I can't remember what they were called, yeah. The coils or whatever it is.
Sure. Yeah. So that particular instance, Mr. Rosenberger, you described this in the transcript, he cleaned the condenser coils. And what you do is you clean the inside of them with, I believe it was a hose or a pressure washer. And to lay people, you only see the outside. And if the outside is dusty, you'd assume it's not clean and it's not working. However, he did clean the inside. And this is an example of an apprentice mistake. He essentially was doing it by the book. He cleaned the inside to make it function properly, while a journeyman may know to clean the outside so that the facilities manager or whoever else is walking through thought that it was.
And on the coils, I mean, your client did show that he was very surprised that he didn't think it was decided that it was not done well enough, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So from his point of view, he was doing a good job. I mean, would that be a fair statement?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. He thought that he cleaned them how he's supposed to. So moving on.
One other follow-up to the line of questions I was asking earlier. So there were clients of Mr. Rosenberger's employer who directed him of the need to bring tools to the site, not the employer. That's your position.
This was the Great Lakes facilities manager.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it reasonable for an employer to expect that an employee will follow the directives and meet the expectations of clients of the employer?
It is. And more specifically, a journeyman, because an apprentice.
Did Mr. Rosenberg meet the expectations of the client of the employer?
He did for the first 2 weeks while he was there with the journeyman.
I'm talking about his failure to bring the tools. So the clients have said, bring the tools.
Yeah.
You've acknowledged that part of the job responsibility is to meet the expectations of the clients. And he's told on more than one occasion to bring the tools to the site. And you're saying that's not a reasonable expectation of the employer because it didn't come from the employer directly, but it came indirectly. I'm not sure that you're... Having recognized the need to meet the client's expectations as an expectation of the employer, how is it that you're arguing that he did meet the expectations of his employer?
So he didn't meet the expectations of Great Lakes, and then therefore did not meet the expectations of Southtown if their expectations were reasonable, which they would have been if he was a journeyman. However, he was not here. And it's not reasonable to expect that your conduct would not result in complaints when Southtown put an apprentice at their most valuable customer's job site worth approximately $250,000, even after the first complaints came in.
Mr. Wallace, I can go back to the record, but you know, I realize that the ALJ referred to your client as a journeyman versus an apprentice. Is there anything in the record that supports the fact that as an apprentice that he has a lot to learn and that he asked questions or went outside of his, went within that capacity to say, I don't know what's going on, I don't know how to do this?
There is. In the transcript, Mr. Rosenberger mentions that after his journeyman left, he looked towards the maintenance manager for direction on fixing an exhaust fan, but he wasn't given any by the maintenance manager. And he said, without this direction, he didn't know how he would have been able to help out on this particular task. He additionally mentions in his reconsideration letter, as well as a transcript, that he needs to look towards a journeyman for direction because as an apprentice, he doesn't know how to do a lot of these things, including what tools he'll need for a particular task or where he'll be working for the day, hence why he did not always bring his tools with him.
Can I push back on the theory that you raised that it was Great Lakes and not his employer who presented the expectation to show up with all of his tools? I mean, am I correct that he was specifically hired to service this particular client most of his time?
That's correct, yeah.
So why wouldn't the expectations of the client essentially be the expectations of the employer?
The expectations of the client, essentially, if their expectations are the same, it shouldn't matter because it was an unreasonable expectation to hold him to the standard of a journeyman when he, in fact, was not.
And when you say it's unreasonable, by what standard are you asking us to say that it's unreasonable? Just our own view that he didn't need to bring his tools to the worksite after being asked to do so? What's the standard?
The standard is that conduct an average reasonable employee would have engaged in under the circumstances is not misconduct.
Right. But if an average reasonable employee is told by his supervisor, bring the tools to the work site, you're saying that's an unreasonable request because the tools are too heavy for him to bring, or he shouldn't have had to bring them because he had a different title. I just want to understand specifically what you're asking us to hold.
Yes, more so because he had a different title. He should be held to the standard of an average, reasonable, unsupervised apprentice. And an average, reasonable, unsupervised apprentice would not know the tools that he would need for a particular task unless he was told.
Would an average, reasonable apprentice know to bring the tools to the site if asked to bring the tools to the site by someone who's expecting to perform services?
Yes. And I believe what happened here was it was more of a broad request to need tools on your person. That does not specifically inform him what tools he will need once again. This court has laid out specific conduct that imperfect performance, essentially, that amounted to simple unsatisfactory conduct. And here the court should view, well, in the decision, the ULJ said that Mr. Rosenberger was discharged for, quote, poor work performance. And poor work performance should be viewed similarly to simple unsatisfactory conduct in that it means work that is not satisfactory to the employer.
Right, but we're talking about disregarding a directive. Would your argument be the same if his employer said, I want to put in writing to you what your expectations are, and we expect you to bring the tools, not just to the, in your van, but bring them to the work site, bring all of your tools to the work site. You're saying that wouldn't have been misconduct for your client to disregard that directive, even if it had been in writing.
That could have been, but that's not what we have here.
What makes it reasonable if it's in writing and not reasonable if it's just verbal, oral?
That would be a specific order, some form of guidance, some form of direction. Here, he lacked all of that.
Right, but the only difference between what my hypothetical was and the circumstances is one was in writing by the supervisor and the other one was oral by a client representing 80% of your client's workload. So I just want to be clear. Your position is if the directive is in writing, then it's reasonable. If it's oral, then it's not reasonable. And I'm trying to understand, why would we make that kind of a distinction?
Not necessarily. It's more specific, and it's a form of a direction. I mean, that's not the facts that we have here, and it would be a better argument on behalf of Southtown if there was written directives towards him. But here he was just given Great Lakes complaint. Don't do it again, essentially.
And he did it again.
The third complaint actually was that he was not actively working. That was the first two before his warning was that he went up to the roof without the tools. I believe I'm running short on time. For these reasons, we ask this court to reverse and find Mr. Rosenberger eligible for unemployment benefits.
All right. Ms. Phillips, would you like to present the arguments for deed?
Yes, thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Carrie Phillips and I represent Respondent Department of Employment and Economic Development, or deed. So relator's conduct here is employment misconduct and not just simple unsatisfactory conduct, because he was specifically instructed to bring his tools to the job site and not stand around. And he continued to not bring his tools to the job site and stand around after that warning. So like the court reasoned in Schmigdahl, the first time he didn't bring his tools or was seen standing around, that may be excusable and not employment misconduct. But Southtown did not discharge relator at that point. Mr. Kirk brought him in for a meeting, they sat down, and he discussed these complaints he had received. And at that point, relator did not express any concerns. He didn't say he needed more instruction. He went back to work and he continued to do the same things. Importantly, the evidence here doesn't show that the relator was unable.
Does the record clarify how precisely his supervisor informed him that he has to treat the client's expectations as his actual job responsibilities, that he must comply as if he's working directly with an employer's supervisor in a direct chain of authority?
Well, the record tells us that Mr. Kirk, who worked for Southtown, called relator into a meeting. So he was meeting with a Southtown representative. And in his testimony, he just says, I discussed the complaints with him, specifically what they were. And I told him these were the customer's complaints. So that's what the record tells us. We would argue that it was Southtown's expectation that he comply with those requests of the customer. Like I said, it was a Southtown representative who addressed those with him. So he knew that Southtown expected him to bring his tools to the job site and to not stand around so that the customer wouldn't complain anymore to make that customer happy.
Does the record inform us that he ever raised the concern either to Great Lakes or Southtown that perhaps the expectation to bring tools to the site was not a reasonable expectation?
He did not raise that concern. The ULJ did ask Mr. Kirk, when you discussed these complaints with him in that July 9th meeting, did he give you any reason why he wasn't doing these things? And Mr. Kirk said no. He said he seemed a little surprised and concerned, but he didn't give any explanation. The same thing when he was discharged, he didn't provide any kind of explanation as to why these things, why they happened.
No, I'm clearly no expert in the field of his service, but it's not uncommon if I call a plumber or an HVAC technician or some other tradesman to my home or workplace to do some work that they first show up to assess what is the issue. And before bringing in all their tools of their trade, that's a reasonable approach, isn't it, to a service position like this?
That may be reasonable. And here, the reason this is employment misconduct is because he was expressly directed that he needs to bring his hand tools when he shows up at the job. He was told that, specifically at the meeting. And some of the testimony from Mr. Kirk is he was told that by other people too. The service tech told him he needs to do that. But we know for sure from Mr. Kirk's own firsthand testimony that he was instructed he needs to bring his tools to the job site. And in the cross-examination, when Mr. Kirk is asking him questions, relator does seem to admit that he was expected to bring his general hand tools to the job. He then kind of pivots a little bit in his testimony and he says, well, I thought that Matt was going to bring those general hand tools. So his testimony is a little inconsistent as to why he wasn't doing that, but he does seem to admit that he knew he was supposed to bring his general hand tools to the job every day. And that was something that was discussed on July 9th.
We don't use these words, but draw an implicit line between misconduct and just neglectful, perhaps lazy performance?
So some of the cases cited by relator in his brief talk about that simple, unsatisfactory conduct where someone, may make mistakes or may lack the skills to do their job.
I'm talking about something a little different here, not just mistakes, but sort of laziness, not applying the effort that's expected. That's not misconduct, is it?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think it comes down to ability and inability. Does somebody have the ability to do what the employer is asking him to do? In this case, it was a pretty simple directive, bring your tools and look like you're working, actively work while you're there. So those are things that he was specifically asked to do. So it's not a matter of not knowing how to do those things.
Yeah, but really we're just talking about an employee that the employer thinks is a bit lazy compared to other service techs, right?
Right. And again,
why is that misconduct? Why is just being lazy misconduct? Isn't that just neglect?
Well, again, I think before the warning, it may just be, unsatisfactory conduct. But he had the warning. He was on notice that the customer was not happy with his conduct. He was on notice that it was a problem. So he was then, he had the duty to make more effort to, if he didn't know how to do something, ask a question, let the employer know he didn't know how to do it. At the very least, he could bring his tools to the job site every day. That's something he certainly was able to do. So here, I think, the situation that you've given as an example, that may not be employment misconduct if an employee doesn't have any reason to know that that's a problem.
Well, once... but, if, What if an employer, if it's a different case, and the employer just says, you know, Fred, I think you're lazy. Don't be so lazy in the workplace. And Fred continues to act in a way that is objectively, would be considered lazy. Is that misconduct?
Well, I think the ULJ would ask Fred questions like, did you make any efforts to not be lazy anymore?
Assume he didn't. I'm just talking about whether laziness itself is misconduct.
I think it can be misconduct. If the facts show that.
Doesn't the statute sort of, doesn't use the word lazy, of course, but doesn't the statutory references to negligent work, neglectful work, doesn't that imply laziness as opposed to misconduct?
So negligent conduct can be employment misconduct if it's serious. And I think it becomes serious when somebody is on notice that they need to improve and they don't. I think that negligent conduct can not be employment misconduct if it's not serious. And again, that goes back to maybe someone, you know, wasn't on notice that they might be discharged for this type of conduct, or if they were trying to improve.
It feels to me like Deed has a better argument in framing this more of a case of insubordination. You were told to do something very specific and didn't do it.
I agree. And I think that his own testimony shows that his decision to not bring the tools to the website was intentional. I mean, he testifies, this was my practice to not bring the tools. So, I mean, I would argue that conduct by his own testimony is intentional conduct. But the ULJ did find that his conduct was negligent. You know, he had a duty to perform work while he was on the job site and he didn't. So the ULJ, you know, characterized that as negligence. You know, I think certainly with the tools, that was intentional conduct because
he was going to the same job site as compared to Judge Ross's example. If he went to Judge Ross's house, take a look and size it up, go to Workie's house, take a look, size it up. But he was going to the same place. That was his primary responsibility, wasn't it?
It was. He was going to the Great Lakes job site. And I think he admitted he was expected to bring his general hand tools to the job site.
The next question I was going to ask you, did he even bring the general hand tools, a hammer?
Right. I interpret the testimony to be he didn't bring his tools. He didn't bring any of the tools. I don't think there was any testimony that he brought some, but not the right tools. The testimony was he was told to bring his tools and he didn't do it. And his own testimony was, well, I decided not to do that. I chose not to do that. That was not my practice. So it does show kind of an intentional, ignoring the employer's instruction.
Is there any evidence of intent to not properly clean those coils that I asked about?
No, the ULJ didn't make a lot of findings or reasoning on the coils. I would say that the coils is not part of the employment misconduct. I think the ULJ identified the not showing up with tools and then standing around not working as the employment misconduct. So I would say that just the coils, that incident with the coils is not in itself employment misconduct. That's more like poor work performance where he just didn't do a good job, but there's no evidence that he continued to do that.
Ms. Phillips, could you clarify for me, we're talking about he was not showing up with the tools, meaning the tools were in his truck, he just didn't bring them inside, or he didn't even have his tools in his truck, so he could go out to his truck and get them.
Sure. So the employer's testimony was he'd arrive at the job site without his tools repeatedly. He testified, well, I had them in my van. So I would get to the job site and I'd go see what needed to be done. And then I'd go back to my van and get them. But that was violating the employer's expectations because they told him he needed to arrive with his tools. And he wasn't doing that. So,
but he had his tools with him. They were just in the van.
That's what he said. That was his testimony.
Did the ULJ make a determination of whether that was true or false?
Well, the ULJ found his testimony to lack credibility in general, but the ULJ didn't specifically address whether he had them in the van or not, and whether his testimony on that specific point. The ULJ found that he...
Would that matter whether they're in the van or not if he was asked to bring them to the actually to the site itself?
No, I believe that the instruction was to bring the tools to the job site every day so he could be ready to work, and he wasn't doing that. So the instruction the instruction was to bring them to work.
What's the job site? I mean, if the job site is a building and he's parked outside the building and the tools are in his van and all he has to do is walk out and get them, hasn't he brought the tools to the job site?
No, the instruction was to bring them to the job site. I don't know, you know, how far he parked from where the job site was. You know, my impression was he had to then take the time to leave the job site and go to his van and get them. And the instruction was bring them, just bring your tools to work when you get here, bring your general tools every day. And he wasn't doing that. So, you know, the employer told him what the expectation was, and he was choosing, you know, not to do that because, you know, maybe he thought, what's the big deal? I'm just going to run out to my van. But that's not what instruction was. The instruction was be here ready to work with your tools. So it's maybe kind of like showing up late. That would take him extra time to go and do that when he could just show up with them in the first place. So it was a reasonable expectation. He was aware of it. It was addressed in a meeting, and he continued to, you know, intentionally not follow that directive from the employer. I believe I have touched on this, but, you know, kind of addressing the argument that he lacked the necessary experience to do these jobs. You know, the complaint from the customer was not that he lacked experience or that he was doing a poor job or making a mistake. The complaint was that he was standing around not working. And so he knew that this was the, that was a concern. So after that, if he really did not know what to do, it was reasonable for the employer to expect him to let somebody know that and ask for help or ask for instruction. And so the argument that he didn't have the experience to do that, and that's why he was standing around, is not a good excuse. That was still employment misconduct as well. And again, this case is like the Schmigdahl and the McGowan case. This kind of moves into the territory of employment misconduct because he was ignoring kind of basic requests from the employer, requests that he was aware of and requests that he could certainly have complied with. There's no evidence that he was unable to comply with those requests. And that kind of makes this case different from some of the cases cited by Relator. Well, I believe I've covered the points that I wanted to make today. If there's no further questions, I'll just conclude and respectfully request that the court affirm the ULJ's decision in this matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wallace, do you have a rebuttal argument for us?
No, we have nothing further to say, Your Honor. We just request that this court reverse the decision and award Mr. Rosenberger unemployment benefits. Thank you.
Very good. I don't see any indication of any other questions from the panel, so we will accept the arguments as submitted and get your decisions to you within 90 days as required by statute. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
It looks like we are about 5 minutes ahead. Could we take two? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are ready for our third case on the oral argument calendar this morning. That case is Kathy Marie Fuller, petitioner respondent versus Jeffrey Allen Fuller, appellant, case number A211263. Would each of the attorneys be kind enough to state their name before beginning any leg of their argument so we have a record of for the audio recording of the proceeding? Also be mindful of the timekeeping mechanism up in the left-hand corner of the screen and watch for judges to interrupt you with questions. At this time, we'd like to hear from counsel for appellant. Please introduce yourself for the record and start the argument.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Amber Lamers and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Jeffrey Fowler. The issue in front of the court from appellant's perspective is that the district court abused its discretion by failing to consider the capital gains and tax consequences appellant will face upon the sale of the land and the equipment awarded to him in the dissolution. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. In this case, the district court made findings and conclusions that are contrary to logic and the facts on the record. The district
court— I'm gonna interrupt you right away. You know, this is, let's face it, dissolution actions have to do with real life. And part of your argument, a large part of your argument on the 675 acres is he wants to sell or transition to his son in 4 to 6 years. 4 to 6 years, he could be remarried. I mean, let's be frank, this can happen. He could be dead. He could decide to sell it to somebody else if the farming son decides to leave the farm. Why would we say that there was error by Judge Opat in determining that capital gains should not be factored into this? How is that erroneous when you have a myriad of circumstances that can just as easily happen as selling to son?
Your Honor, the court needs to look at what the evidence was presented. It's not speculative in any nature. There wasn't any testimony that he might—
Is there a purchase agreement between father and son at this point?
There is not. But there was no testimony that he might retire in 4 to 6 years. It was 3 to 5 years. We're now looking at 2 to 4 years. The appellant is 68 years old. He's retired from full-time employment.
But you admit there's other options that this fellow could have. I mean, my farmer husband is 70 years old, and do you think I can get him to stop farming? No. That's reality. So these other things can happen. He could decide to sell it to someone else, and we don't know whether the son is going to continue farming. Aren't these equally possible as far as options that can happen as the clock goes tick, 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 tick?
So there's a lot of questions in there, Your Honor. Certainly death is certain, right? So he could die. That's not the evidence before the court. The record shows that
what's that?
The evidence he's alive. He's alive.
No,
he is farming.
Does the court need evidence that he could die before he transfers the land? Is that, that be in the record?
No, that was the that was one of the factors that could possibly exist given by your honors. So he testified that he is going to retire within 3 to 5 years. We're now looking at 2 to 4 years because of the time that's passed. He is 68 years old at the time. Certainly he could sell it to somebody else other than
his son. Why can't he change his mind? I mean, I'm just trying to get you to acknowledge that there's other possibilities. Saying you're going to do something next year could even change as January, February, March rolls on.
Absolutely.
Is that not possible?
It's absolutely possible, but that's not what the case law states. So the case law in Aaron and Maurer look at whether there is too much speculation for the district court to consider the tax consequences. In this case, my client testified specifically, he will retire within 3 to 5 years. His son testified specifically, he will buy the land. The accountant testified specifically as to the capital gains and tax consequences that appellant will sustain within 3 to 5 years. So the case law states that it doesn't even have to be something that will occur in the near future, but there can't be complete speculation, such as in the Aaron case where the husband testified that the apartments that he was being awarded were a long-term investment. So the court—
Wouldn't it be equally then tit for tat if the farmland had been awarded to wife in terms of how she proposed it to be divided? Wouldn't she also have had capital gains that would have been considered? I mean, isn't that, if it had went to her, would he be agreeable?
If it had went to her, which it did not, and if she had requested an offset for capital gains, which she did not, then the court would have discretion to consider that. Those are not the facts in the case before the court. In the facts in the case before the court, my client's expert testified specifically to the capital gains and tax consequences he will sustain within 3 to 5 years. If you look at the distribution schedule, this farm is his retirement. He was awarded no other assets. So what the court did when it abused its discretion was to say—
Are you trying to say that farmland is not an asset? I think farmland is at an all-time high and is probably a fine asset. Are you saying it's not an asset? You said he only got the farmland and did not get an asset. Please clarify what you mean.
This farm is his retirement. If you look at the assets awarded—
And what did the wife get that is her retirement? The equivalent of the farm.
She got over $200,000 of retirement assets. She got $300,000 to $400,000 of cash and over $1 million of cash from the farm. So her tax consequences are minimal going forward. She will pay very little tax on the assets awarded to her. Whereas my client, the assets awarded to him, I'm not saying they're not substantial, but this is his retirement plan. And he will pay significant capital gains and tax consequences on the retirement plan, on his retirement plan. For the court to say he should engage in proper estate planning was an abuse of discretion because there was no testimony about any estate planning. The district court acknowledged he is facing substantial tax consequences and capital gains, but stated that it doesn't have to be as large of a concern if he engages in proper estate planning. So what the district court is saying is that my client must gift his retirement asset to his son to avoid any capital gains. This is the only asset he was awarded. And I'm not saying it's insignificant, but once he retires, if he doesn't sell it and he can't work on it anymore, he has to wait till he can die to transfer it to his son. He's not able to reap any of the benefits of the asset that he worked so hard to accumulate during the marriage. So it was an abuse of discretion for the court to completely disregard.
Are you saying that the wife was not an equal contributor? I mean, certainly she was.
Under Minnesota statute, it's presumed she was an equal contributor. Under the findings of this court, she was not an equal contributor. The finding of fact by the district court in its amended conclusions of law is clearly erroneous. There was no testimony about estate planning. There was no evidence in this record about the amount appellant may save by proper estate planning. And there was no testimony or evidence to even suggest that appellant intends on giving away his assets during his lifetime or upon his death. The district court's finding denies appellant his right to reap the benefits of his hard work and receive the value of his property. Citing the case law from respondent's brief, it is within the trial court's discretion to consider the tax consequences of its award. The district court may not consider the tax consequences of a transfer if it must speculate because the evidence is lacking and nonspecific. We agree with respondent's brief. There is nothing speculative about the tax consequences appellant will face. He's testified very clearly of his intent to retire. He testified very clearly of his intent to transfer his land and to sell his land and equipment, not transfer it to his son. Matthew Fowler testified very specifically to his intent to buy it. Whether Matthew Fowler buys it or somebody else buys it, my client still suffers the same capital gains and tax consequences. Their expert, Lynn Miller, provided testimony and documentation verifying the exact amount of capital gains and the tax appellant will pay upon selling his land and his farmland. There was in his equipment. There was nothing speculative about this. I'm also going to go into the response on respondent's brief. Respondent argues the court should simply award each party.
Just so we're clear, maybe I missed it, but I didn't see a reply brief challenging the arguments raised by respondent. Was there a reply brief filed?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't. Somehow I didn't receive it.
It was dated February 15th, 2020.
All right, well, thank you.
Let me ask you a question about that reply brief, because I do find some sympathy to your client here. I mean, one of the arguments that were raised by respondent counsel has to do with the cashier's check. And if I understand the record correctly, the proceeds from that cashier's check that was delayed and reissued, although perhaps secretly reissued by your client, I mean, it went towards regular crop farm operating expenses, didn't it?
It did, and I would like to correct the record. There was no finding that my client secreted away this cashier's check. In fact, the respondent was hiding the cashier's check. My client thought it was lost, had it reissued, and deposited it immediately into a bank account rather than holding it.
I should restate that. He went ahead and spent the funds that were in that cashier's check towards operation, but he spent it without her permission or knowledge.
He put it into the checking account that is utilized for all of the farming operation, the mortgages, the mortgage on the property that she was residing in, all of their expenses. And from that generated a net profit for their 2019 crop of $482,179. He also paid prepays in 2019 for 2020, which she received $62,500 in. At the date of valuation, there was $160,919 remaining in that account, $80,000 of which she received. So,
and of course, that lessened their tax return for that year because of prepays. So they both benefited.
They both benefited, and utilization of that $250,000 cashier's check resulted in her receiving $384,000 of cash. So to then say she also gets another $125,000 would be a complete windfall to her.
All right, I'm sorry, I don't intend to dominate judges, but this case raised an interesting question, and this is what I have for two seasoned attorneys. And it has to do with the smallest financial issue, although toy tractors are a big deal. Why on earth can't two attorneys and two clients put all the tractors in a room and go in, pick a tractor, let the next person go in, pick a tractor? Why can't that be done? There seems to be such adamant opposition in what's going to happen with tractors that belong to a son who unfortunately died in 1999. Is that not possible? Or is this something to be a remand on an issue of dividing up toys?
There was no abuse of discretion on the award of marital assets to my client, so I don't believe a remand is appropriate.
Ms. Lammers, did your client have to participate in the Court of Appeals mediation program?
Yes.
And was this issue even discussed?
This issue was discussed on a motion to compel because my client was never actually provided many of the assets he was awarded. So to say that the two attorneys should sit down, the toy tractors are no longer, cannot be found at the moment is what I can tell you. My client didn't receive
them. Cannot be found? Tractors disappeared? I mean, come on. This is what's wrong with our system of family law today. They disappeared? They went to space? This begs the court's credulity in terms of not only your position, but your client's position. And I best be quiet and not worry about farming issues.
I would say that it has nothing to do with opposing counsel or my inability to work together. These assets, the information that you're asking is outside this record. So rather than put information that's not part of this record, I will rely on my reply brief as far as the lack of abuse of discretion by the district court by awarding those assets to my client.
I understand how the abuse of discretion standard applies in matters like this, where the question is about fairness. What are the components of an abuse of discretion standard when we're trying to decide whether what the district court did was fair with regard to an emotional asset like this?
There was sufficient testimony by my client that he would like the toy tractors. There was not sufficient testimony by the respondent that she wanted the toy tractors. The appellant specifically requested he be awarded them.
I understand all of that. I get the argument. I'm just trying to get a sense of I know it's an abuse of discretion standard, but what is that? How do we apply that standard in a case where the district court is distributing an asset in which the parties are emotionally attached? What is it? On what ground do we say the court acted within its discretion or didn't?
Make findings that are unsupported by the record. It did not. I have 1 minute left and I really want to focus on respondents' request to divide up the farm, if I'm allowed. The toy tractors is such a minimal issue in this case. I'm surprised that they're up on appeal. Again, my client doesn't have them, so he can't come back to her. But with regard to respondents' argument that the court should simply award part of the farm to her, the argument is against logic, the evidence presented, the findings made by the court, and the applicable case law. The case law says it's proper for the trial court to consider the preservation of an operable farm and to award the land to a party most likely to continue farming. The court made substantial findings to support its decision to award all the farmland to my clients. Contrary to respondents' argument, the district court did not award the farmland to appellant based on his desire to transfer his land to his adult son. And I think it goes against the argument that respondent is making, where she's saying that on one hand, the district court cannot award this land to a non-party, but on the other hand, the court needs to consider the fact that he can transfer it to his adult son to avoid capital gains and tax consequences. Those two arguments are contrary to one another. Regardless, there was no testimony that my client was asking for this farm to be awarded to him to transfer it to his son, nor did the court make findings saying that. Also, I know my time is up. I just want to briefly state one more thing if the court will allow it.
You may.
A respondent's own expert testified that by her rate of return, if she is awarded the farmland, rents out the farmland, her rate of return is 2.3%. If she takes her cash equalization payment and invests that, her rate of return is 4%. So it is inequitable and illogical to break this farmland up, destroy the operation, and give the respondent part of the farm operation. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Would you state your name before proceeding with your argument?
Yes, Jill Frieders on behalf of the respondent, Kathy Fowler. And it's clear the court is fully aware of the issues before it. I'm going to start with the cashier's check. This is a case where the cashier's check was from a certificate of deposit that matured in 2014. The check was being held because the parties couldn't agree on what to do with it.
Can I take you off the rails? And
sure.
I mean, I'm interested in your argument about the cashier's check, but I am especially interested in the argument as to the capital gains that we spend a lot of time on now. I am concerned that, that there's not enough in the record, perhaps, to support the district court's conclusion when we have a clear indication of the intent to dispose of the property or use the property in a certain way. I'd like you to address that issue.
Yes. So Mr. Fowler testified that he intends to transfer the property to his son at some time in the future at an unknown price. His testimony was that they'd had discussions, but there was no concrete plan in place, no price had been decided, and that the goal was to transfer the property to son. During the pendency of this matter, Mr. Fowler inherited land from his mother, and rather than take the land, he allowed it to be transferred to his son instead. He didn't sell it to his son. He simply transferred it to it, or allowed the transfer to be to his son. So there's a lot of evidence in the record that the goal is to keep the farm in the family and for the land to go to the son. The court indicated that there are estate planning tools in place that would allow that to happen, and that it wasn't clear. The court made findings, I think oral and in writing, that there's not, that the court wasn't convinced that there was a plan to.
Well, what was what is the evidence in the record as to the estate planning tools that the district court was speculating? Why isn't that speculation?
I think it's law, not speculation, but the court said that's an availability. And what maybe this.
Did the court indicate what the availability is and specify how it would work in real life based upon the actual property?
Yes. Let me get to my, I quoted the court's findings. It's an oral finding. It was the May 25th, 2021 transcript, and the court talked about.
Am I the only one that's lost?
We lost her. Yeah. We've lost her. Counsel?
We should probably pause the clock.
Yeah. Marshall, could you stop the clock for a moment? Thank you. Maggie, do you have a way to reach her? Thank you. Appreciate that.
Ms. Lammers, this happens all the time in real life when we ask hard questions. Lawyers just freeze completely like this.
Thank you very much.
I think we were talking about what kind of estate planning tools are available.
You dropped off right when you were explaining where in the record you believe the court sufficiently established a finding as to the consequences.
It's an oral finding at on the May 25th, 2021 transcript, pages 26 to 28. And it's printed page 21 of my brief, where the judge talked about the goal here is clearly to keep the farm and the family, for it to be transferred to Matt Fowler, the son, that it's a significant advantage to the son. And the court said, so there's any number of ways that Mr. Fowler can structure this, that if I were to give him over $1 million and some dollar credit, and he uses one of these options in estate planning with his son, then he would be getting a windfall here, and this court is not going to make a determination on. I just don't think it's appropriate at this point, given the uncertainty of if he's going to sell. But I think that there was certainty in this court's understanding of the testimony that he wanted the property to remain in the family, would continue the family farm, and that his son would have the property. So the court has already taken that into consideration, is not going to consider that issue, and is not going to grant respondent the capital gains. I think that's very important, because when you look at Mr. Fowler's testimony, Mr. Fowler testified that he doesn't have, there's no purchase agreement, there's no agreed upon price to sell to Matthew. The capital gains that the accountant testified to assumed that they were going to be using the appraised value in the sale, but Mr. Fowler testified that there's no agreement between he and his son as to what the purchase price will be, or when it's going to when he's going to sell. If you look at his testimony, he says he hopes to sell when Matthew is able to buy. And he's hoping to retire in 3 to 5 years, but continue to farm with his son. He most certainly can hold his land and rent it out, which is what many farmers do for their retirement. Or he could sell, keep it, sell it. I mean, there's many number of things he could do, but it's clear that he's not going to do it immediately. And if his goal is to really sell in 3 to 5 years, which is now in about 2 years, if he's really going to sell it on the open market at the price that the appraisal was at, why not sell it to his wife? He's got a buyer right now. And there would be no capital gains consequence with respect to that sale, which is what she wanted. She wanted the land. She wanted the land because she too had worked hard to acquire this land. This land is has sentimental value to her. In addition, she understands farming. She understands how to rent the land out. And the land is a great investment. It only goes, I shouldn't say only goes up in value. There's some up and down, but over time it goes up in value and is a significant asset that she would like to have.
But so, as to what's in the record regarding his retirement plans and the asset being maintained for his retirement, can you explain how the district court's analysis sufficiently bears upon that so as to avoid an abuse of discretion determination?
Well, I don't think that the court made a retirement plan on this. I mean, Mr. Fowler's testimony was he's going to farm as long as he can, and that he intends to farm as long as he can. I don't see him, there was no indication that he was going, I'm not sure that I can answer your question exactly, because even if he sells to his son or transfers to his son, Mr. Fowler indicated he was going to continue to farm. So the land is.
So that wouldn't work with your notion of renting out the farmland.
Well, if he rents the farmland, he's going to receive rental income, and that would be
Ms.
his
Frieder,
income.
Isn't it true? We don't know what. Let's just assume that there is some certainty that they are bound to enter into the sale. Is there any information as to how that sale would be fashioned? In other words, would it be a contract for deed? Would it be some type of shared farming operation? Would it be sold in various parcels over a projected period of time. Do we have any idea how this farmland is intended to be transferred?
Mr. Fowler's testimony was that he would sell to his son when his son was able to buy, if and when he was able to buy. There's no true timeline.
That's my point. We don't have any idea if the son is even financially qualified to buy this land.
Correct. Correct. Yes, I mean, there, I think, you know, there's no indication even what the sales price is going to be. And if we don't know the sales price, we don't know the capital gains. He could sell it at a very reduced price to his son. And the capital gains would be, if that sale occurs, then the capital gains would be much less. So no, we have, there's no indication on the record as to when the sale is going to occur, what the sales price will be. What we do know is that Mr. Fowler feels strongly that Mrs. Fowler shouldn't receive land because the land should ultimately go to their son, Matthew. On the, I'm going to go back to the cashier's check. There was no clear evidence as to how Mr. Fowler spent the money that was in that cashier's check. His testimony.
Well, he testified it was for regular ongoing farming purposes, and you didn't, through discovery, discern any evidence that he went and bought a Corvette or went and bought, a new combine or something else, did you?
No, but his testimony was that his testimony at trial was that the money was still in the bank. And then when I showed him the bank account.
Well, I understand all the fault and finger pointing that both of these parties have done to each other. I get that. I get that he was, at least your client indicates that he indicated he would put it on hold or would agree to escrow it. But we're talking about the evaporation of that fund and where it went. Point to me any piece of evidence that shows that he bought a motorcycle or something out of the ordinary farming, ongoing input, expenditures, everything that has to do with maintenance of buildings. Was there anything at all? I mean, if you show me he bought a Tootsie Roll, I'd be happy to hear that, but I can't find anything in the record that there was anything but farming operations that were a part of that expenditure.
No, I can't show that he took the money and bought an asset. His testimony was that he kept the money in his accounts and that he didn't spend it. When he was confronted with the fact that the money wasn't there anymore, he then said that he spent it on farming expenses, but he was never able to provide an accounting of how he spent it.
Ms. Frieders, I know Ms. Lammers doesn't feel that it's worthy of appellate review, or at least that's what I gleaned from her testimony, but I want to hear about these toy tractors. And I mean, let's face it, every farm family has, I expect every farm family probably has cupboards of toy farm tractors that are valuable. What was wrong, or what happened with Judge Opat as far as the division? Tell me what your position is.
Oh,
well, tell me this, why can't you divide them?
I don't know why we can't divide them. The tractors were originally awarded solely to Mr. Fowler. At our post-trial motions, the judge slightly amended its decision and said, I'm leaving the award to Mr. Fowler, but I hope that Mr. Fowler will agree that Mrs. Fowler can have half of them. So
if you attempt to work something out and you do, great. If you can't, then I assume you go back to district court and you fight about it. Why are we talking about that here on appeal? I don't understand this.
Because the Judge Opat's order awarded the toys to Mr. Fowler with a caveat, but wouldn't it be nice if Mr. Fowler would agree for her to have half of them? He didn't order Mr. Fowler to give her half. He said, I hope Mr. Fowler will give her half. So there's no order giving half.
Well, provide for us the standard, the application of the standard of review. Let's assume there was no order. Let's treat his caveat as simply a wishful thinking. On what basis would we say, even if we didn't like the outcome, on what basis would we say how would we analyze this to say this was an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think the court made a finding that the party should each receive half, but allowed the control to be with Mr. Fowler.
Well, it made a sort of a moral finding that it would be great if the party shared. But what is the basis for us? Let's assume the district court didn't say that. But the district court just said, you know, it'd be nice, but I'm not going to issue an order. Either party can have these, and it's not an issue for me. Well, on what basis would we say our abuse of discretion standard directs us to reverse? What is the analysis? I'm trying to understand the legal framing and how we would actually assess the district court's discretion and the
remedy. So this is court of equity. If the court believes that it's equitable for the parties to each have half, then the court should make that decision as opposed to give that power to one of the parties. It's the court of equity. If in equity, the court believes that both parties should receive a portion of the deceased child's toys, then the court should have made that award rather than give that power to one party over the other.
And I'm not sure how this is properly before us, though. If you're saying that OPAT's order is giving him to husband and with a hope that he would do the right thing, and the order is giving it to husband, how is it properly before us? We would have to determine it's an abuse of discretion, send it back and say, Judge OPAT, figure out what to do with these tractors because you didn't divide it fairly. I'm trying to figure out what you want us to do. Yeah.
Yes, I would like for you to remand it back to Judge OPAT with instructions that they divide the deceased child's toys equitably between the parties, 50-50 or however.
So you're saying, so the legal hook on this is you're saying the court made an equitable determination without providing an equitable enforcement mechanism.
Correct. Yeah. The court the court's finding is the court would like the parties to amicably resolve the issue by Mr. Fowler agreeing to allow Ms. Fowler items of sentimental value that belong to their deceased son.
Right. What is the case law that supports your position that on appeal, it's our duty to direct the district court to provide an enforcement mechanism for a matter of moral or fairness that the court observed? Is there some case that says this is the remedy?
I'm not aware of any case where a judge has said, I'm awarding all of this class of assets to one party with the hope that that party will do the right thing.
May I ask a question?
You may.
Yes.
And I know we're out of time. That's why I asked for permission for the question. Ms. Frieders, was there any inventory of the tractors that we know which tractors belong to whom and which son? I presume not, and you're shaking your head no. Then my question is only this. No, it's not a question. It's just going to be a statement that perhaps you and your client can talk about the futility of going back to court, trying to get something that apparently is not going to be willingly given to you. That's my comment for you.
Certainly.
Do we have rebuttal argument?
Yes, thank you. I just want to note with the tractors, so the case law is set forth in my reply brief, which says a district court's decision regarding the division of property will not be overturned absent clear abuse of discretion, even if the appellate court may have divided the property differently. I also note in the findings of fact in the order, it simply says this was already awarded to respondent. Petitioner is to turn over what she still has in her possession by June 1st. So while on the record, Judge OPAT might have made a sentimental comment that I hope these parties can divide it, that was not his finding. The finding was that petitioner needed to turn them over to the respondent by June 1st, which did not occur. With regard to the oral findings set forth on page 21 of respondent's brief, that is speculation. All of those findings are based on speculation. The case law doesn't require a purchase agreement to be in place for the court to consider the capital gains. It also supports that the taxes and capital gains can be based on the current appraised value of the land. Mr. Fowler wanted an all or nothing approach to the farmland, because if you break up the farmland and award some of it to the respondent, it will destroy his farming operation. The court made specific findings, finding of fact 25, stating that respondent's request to break up this farmland was to make the appellant suffer. This is a no-fault state. To then remand this case or to have a different decision to break up this farmland is making this a fault case, where respondent's testimony was clear in that her motive was to make him suffer because she blamed him for the breakdown of their dissolution or the breakdown of their marriage. I would like to clarify, there was a question regarding, was there any testimony as far as how Matthew Fowler intends on purchasing the farmland? And there was. Matthew Fowler testified that he intends to obtain lender financing or purchase the farm on a contract for deed. Mr. Fowler testified that he will sell it as his son can afford it, either through lender financing or on a contract for deed. If it's a contract for deed, he is still subject to the same taxes and capital gains. It's just over a period of time. Contrary to the statement set forth by respondent, the court did not conclude appellant was not going to sell the land, nor did the court find that his goal was to transfer it. There was never a finding that appellant lacked any credibility with his testimony. The only finding made was that it was not going to offset to make an offset to either party for capital gains or tax consequences that will occur either now in the future on the sale of real estate being awarded. That finding is clearly erroneous because respondent received no real estate and she requested no offset on taxes that she may pay for any asset awarded to her. We do believe that the court abused its discretion by failing to consider the substantial testimony about the tax consequences and capital gains that appellant will sustain within a very near future when he sells this property. We are asking that the court reverse the decision and remand it to include the findings that my client set forth in his brief and in the motion for amended findings regarding its finding of fact 27, it would be adding 28 through 40, which is set forth in our brief, that clarifies the exact amount of taxes he will sustain when he sells this land, and that the court shall take into consideration the tax consequences and capital gains he will pay.
And how could we do this, to be clear? We would base that on what tax year? I mean, what current capital gains?
It would be based on the evidence and the record. There is an exhibit setting forth exactly how much capital gains and taxes he will pay based on what the court determined the value of the land to be. So appellant had an expert testify as to his belief as to the value of the land. Respondent did the same. The court took an average of the two. The expert, Lynn Miller, provided the capital gains and taxes that appellant will pay on the average appraisals. And it's not a small amount.
And of course, if farmland plummets, it will not be as much. And if farmland hopefully continues to go up and up and up, it will be much more.
Yes, but I can only base my argument based on the facts and the record, Your Honor.
And so just to be clear, you would ask us not to make any projections or direct the district court to make any projections, but to base it on the assumption of a sale or a transfer at the present time.
Based on the average of the appraisals that the court found the land to be worth. So the depreciation schedule show the actual purchase price of the farmland at $1,344,949. To determine the capital gains, they use the average appraised value that the court adopted. He will pay $1,153,231 of capital gains on the farmland and equipment. That does not include any personal taxes.
And just to be clear, I see your time has expired, but during the break when we were trying to get everything sorted out technologically, just so you're clear, Ms. Lamers, it wasn't the court that misplaced your reply brief. I think it seems like the other judges had your reply brief. It just didn't show up and I now have it. So just so you're at ease, we have it and it will be fully considered by all of us in making our decision.
And I wasn't sure, that's why I cited the Servin case, which answered your question as far as the abuse of discretion and how to utilize it on the division of the toys.
No, I just didn't make it into my papers, but I have found that my staff has passed it on to me now electronically. Oh, so thank you.
Thank
sorry,
you.
Sorry for any confusion.
Thank you. I saw Ms. Frieder's nodding her head that she had it, so I know somebody got it.
I think that concludes the hearing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. And that takes care of the court's oral argument calendar this morning. Thank you for appearing.
Thank you.
I think we still have others in the court in the room.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you, Maggie. We will. Judge Werke, you're not here today.
No, and I'm so sad I'm not. I didn't get